You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
You're listening to the Co-Main Event Podcast. And now your hosts, Ben Foulkes and Chad Dundas.
That's right. You're listening to another episode of the Co-Main Event Mixed Martial Arts Podcast. I'm Chad Dundas. That's Ben Foulkes. We're both longtime MMA journalists, and for almost the last 12 years, we've been meeting here every week to break down all the action in the wild, weird, and occasionally wonderful world of mixed martial arts. Ben, we had dueling fight shows this weekend. You had the UFC, of course, down there in Mexico City, putting on this Fight Night event headlined by Brandon Royval and Brandon Moreno. And then, of course, you had the PFL versus Bellator pay-per-view sort of kicking off this era of this combined company to, in some ways, I suppose, rival the UFC. A bunch of championships on the line down there for that one. And a lot of kind of interesting results all over the place. And so we're going to spend the bulk of the show talking about that stuff. But we got to talk about this first, man. Did you see, prior to the co-main event of this UFC Fight Night event, where Brian Ortega ultimately emerges victorious over Yair Rodriguez, but did you see Brian Ortega apparently injure himself during the introductions to the fight? Because I feel like that is some shit that can only happen in MMA.
I mean, I don't know if you can say that after we just saw a Super Bowl in which a dude injured himself trying to run out onto the field. So it can happen. The weird stuff can happen. I saw a minor league game once, Chad, where a dude blew out his entire knee and was done for the season when he went to do the jump onto home plate at the end of a game-winning home run kind of thing. So it's not like MMA is all alone here. It is different in that when you do this in MMA, you do it right there when the camera is focused solely on you, and then afterwards, you have to try to play it as cool as possible, because the whole audience, not to mention the other dude who stands to gain twice as much money by beating you up, they're all looking at you, they saw you stumble, they saw the kind of panic in your face as you went to go test out that ankle you just rolled up on, and there's a whole, it's kind of like being the gazelle that limps on over to the watering hole. Everybody's going, oh, that one looks like about ready for dinner time, and you got to get it together in a hurry. Credit to Brian Ortega, man.
Yeah.
Can you imagine being in that situation? He said afterwards, I was kind of freaking out right then, trying to kind of no-sell it a little bit, turning to his coach, and you could see he kind of turned to his coach and said something, and afterwards he was saying that he said to his coach, like, it's bad, and the coach is just like, nope. We're not doing that right now. Just focus up. Get your head back in the game. You do that, you know, if you're warming up for an NBA finals and you turn your ankle, you get to go over there, have some guy look at it, maybe add some extra tape to it. Worst case scenario, you go back to the locker room, they probably take an x-ray and an MRI right then and there, and then there's still a lot of game left to get back in. In an MMA fight, you do this stuff, and then they're going to be like, okay, so you ready to go? You ready to fight this guy who just watched you roll your own ankle and might just come right out and kick you in it? Because it's go time.
Yeah. I did not know someone injured themselves running out for the Super Bowl.
Yeah, Dre Greenlaw.
Did he not play? Well,
he didn't injure himself running out on the field for the very beginning of the game, but like later in the game, went to go run out on the field and boop, went down. That was it. The minor league example that I shared was way crazier though, actually, because it was like a walk-off home run, moment of heroics. The whole team gathered around home plate, ready to greet you and pat you on the head. This dude did the whole stop right before you get there, jump up, and then when he landed, he went down like he had been shot. Done for the year after that, Chad.
Jeez. I tell you what, I've been watching fighters do this since all the way back in the Tito Ortiz days. And I always wondered, I always thought to myself, when they jump up and do that kind of knee tuck thing that Brian Ortega was doing, somebody's going to hurt themselves doing that. But then I always thought, you know, they're athletes.
Yeah, professionals.
They know what they're doing. And so I was like, yeah, they'll be fine. And this, you know, Brian Ortega turns his ankle over. Then when he went out to fight, you could see a big old lump on the side of his ankle. And through the good grace of his Lord and Savior, he was able to go out there and win that fight. So good for him, I guess.
You know what, though? It did help me come up with a strategy that we will offer up for somebody via CME consulting services. What if, Chad, what if you went out there for the start of the fight, you're jumping around, you're doing all this stuff, and you fake an injury? You go, oh no, my knee, not my knee, that was my good knee. And you're limping all around and everything. The guy comes out of there, he's like, this dude's knee is done. I'm going to go in there. I'm going to kick that thing right away. I'm going to take advantage. You go to throw that kick at the injured knee, boom, right straight, right down the pipe. Knee was fine all along. Or, you know, the guy's thinking, oh, he's going to be weak on that knee. You head kick right with the same leg. You start playing with their minds, Chad. What do you think?
Yeah, I like it. I love it. You know, I'm a big fan of mind games. Yeah. Anything that involves a mind game, I'm there for it.
That's what they say about you.
Just a reminder, you're listening to the Co-Main Event podcast proper. This show drops every Monday afternoon for free in your timelines and your podcast libraries. But if you're not satisfied, if you're not sated, if you find yourself pining for more of this hot CME action, you can find the Co-Main Event, Ben Foulkes, and myself all week over on Patreon. Hit us up at patreon.com/co-main-event. Get loads of extra audio and video content, as well as access to our official Discord message board. The coolest people in MMA are constantly chatting it up over there 24/7, 365 on any number of topics. As everybody knows, if you've been listening to the show for a while, we offer 7-day free trials at our $5 level. You can jump on board absolutely for free. Check out all the content happening over there. Take a look. Decide if you want to join up for real. Jump on board. We keep telling you, we're a completely independent podcast. We don't have the backing of a big parent company or even one of the major MMA websites. We're just two guys talking into microphones, and we've been doing it for over a decade. But the truth is, we can only keep making the show with your support. Help keep the CME alive by joining up to become a part of the awesome community over at patreon.com/co-main-event. Another great way to support the show is by going over to co-main-event.com. and checking out our new merchandise shop. Just click the link at the top of the page that says shop, and that'll get you there. We still got the daddest man on the planet coffee mugs just flying off the shelves over there. Ever since Christmas, they've been our top seller. So thanks to everybody who stopped by either to get themselves one or to get the daddest man that they know one of those gifts. We also have t-shirts. We got hats. We got hoodies. We got all kinds of stuff you could want. Again, go to our website, comainevent.com, and click the link at the top of the screen that says shop. As always, we partner with our friends at Superconductor on the Shop. They are a brand and design studio from Portland, Oregon. We can't recommend them highly enough. For all your design needs, hit them up at studiosuperconductor.com or on Instagram at studiosuperconductor. We got music this week from our guy, longtime friend, The Fifth Element, a music producer from Fort Worth, Texas. If you like what you hear from him on the show, you can check out more on Twitter at The Fifth Element, on Facebook at facebook.com/The Fifth Element, or soundcloud.com/The Fifth Element. That's the number 5. And as you guys know by now, the letter A in the word the Fifth Element. 3 rounds as usual this week in the Co-Main Event podcast. In round number 1, Brian Ortega flies like an eagle with its beak crushed off and comes back from the dead to tap Yair Rodriguez. And in round number 2, Brandon's Moreno versus Royval was definitely a flyweight fight that happened, by which we mean it was pretty awesome, and probably either Brandon could have won. And in round number 3, in a pay-per-view that announced the emergence of the UFC's biggest competition since Strikeforce, former Bellator fighters dominated PFL fighters. They won them all, except for the big one. All that, plus are you fucking kidding me and just saying stuff. But first, like we always do about this time, let's do a little bit of listener mail.
Listener mail.
First piece of listener mail this week comes to us from our guy Shoulders, Chest, Pants, Shoes, who writes, when it was all said and done, do you think the UFC wishes they would have stayed home at the Apex instead of going to Mexico this past weekend? Underwhelming losses in both the main and co-main from guys like Moreno and Yair, the whole reason we went down there in the first place, sandwiched around the Rosas pullout, questionable judging all night long, and of course, the crowd brawl. How big of a shit show was this event in all? Like I said at the top of the show, a lot of weird stuff happened over the weekend, and I think we're going to talk about some of it as we move on. Was it enough for the UFC to wish that they hadn't gone down there, if they would have stayed at home at the Apex? I don't think so. I think they went to Mexico City. You know, they put 21,500 in the stands. They put on, if nothing else, an entertaining show, an action-packed show. I don't necessarily know that either of the defeats to Yair Rodriguez or Brandon Moreno were underwhelming. I thought they were actually both like fairly compelling, good fights. And really, at the end of the day, I think the UFC just wants to get a foothold in the Mexican fight market. And, you know, they just announced the opening of this Mexico City Performance Institute that they have down there. And I think they did exactly that. I don't think you need all of the fan favorite fighters to win when you go down there to do an event. And, like, you know, a couple other weird happenings. For all we know, it just made people think, hey, you don't know what's going to happen at these UFC events. We got to come back to the next one.
Yeah, I don't think that the UFC, especially the ownership side of it, comes out of this being like, well, that was a mess. Should have just stayed in the warehouse. As we said, it's clear now that among the other tiers of UFC programming, there's now the separate tiers of UFC Fight Night event at the Apex and UFC Fight Night event in a non-Las Vegas location with a full crowd at a packed arena. They clearly are doing different things with those. And if you don't believe me, compare and contrast this Mexico City Fight Night event this past weekend with this weekend's UFC Fight Night Rosenstrike versus Gazeev back there at the Apex. Go and look at who's on the fight card here and the amount of buzz that you're getting for it. And don't just try to tell me after that these are not two separate tiers of UFC event, the caliber of entertainment that they're trying to offer you. I mean, the UFC goes away, you know, you see a big crazy crowd brawl. I think the UFC just goes, it's not like it's the first fight in the crowd we've seen. It's just maybe the biggest. It's just maybe the wildest one that we've seen. But that's anybody who's been to a live UFC event before, you haven't seen a brawl or two in the crowd. That stuff just happens. I also don't think that they come away going like, oh, we were really hoping for certain results from some of these fights. Like the Brian Ortega and Yair Rodriguez fight, that's a great fight. You know, it looks like it's going to be over early on. Brian Ortega battles back into that. You know, the main event is close, like very competitive. I don't think that the UFC is disappointed with those results at all. And frankly, when you see an event in front of a big crowd again, even though it's a fight night event, you are reminded why this feels like such a different experience as a viewer at home than the UFC Apex does.
Next question this week comes to us from our guy, Ricky G, in the place to be. He writes, Raul Rosas got sick and his fight got canceled during the event on Saturday. Please discourse. Raul Rosas Jr. was supposed to go out there and fight Ricky Tercios, and he fell ill, before the event or during the event, couldn't make it out there to fight Tercios that night, but it's already been pushed back 1 week to UFC Fight Night Rozenstruik versus Gazeev that you talked about a minute ago. And so it does sound like we're going to get that fight. One thing that I wondered is, are we going to make these guys cut weight again? Or are we just going to maybe catch weight it, just be like, hey, man, we'll come to a Conor McGregor, Michael Chandler style arrangement where we're just going to go in here and do it at whatever weight? Because, you know, if you're Rosas and you're just coming off, whether it was an illness or, a health issue, whatever it was, do you really want to turn around and do all that stuff over again? I'm not totally sure.
Yeah, well, and I had seen some comment right afterwards anyway from Ricky Tercios being like, I have not agreed to go ahead and rebook that next week. You know, that the UFC was doing that thing again where they said like, oh, don't worry, we've already rebooked it. And the guy was like, I have not signed a single thing to that effect. It does seem like if you want to rebook that one, and if it was an illness that caused the pullout, like, why book it the very next weekend? Like, why not? Because especially it's not like there's anybody sitting around going, well, I'm not going to watch this Apex card unless there's this Ricky Tercios fight on it. Like, if you're going to watch this Saturday's fights, it's because you're just going to watch whatever is on this Saturday. It's not like you absolutely need it. So if it would benefit everybody, if you'd get a better result, like a better effort out of everybody to push it 2-3 weeks, you could also do that. Like, there's space on some of those other cards. And I can understand too being annoyed if you're a Ricky Tercios and you go through all that, you go to Mexico City, or you're cutting weight, you're ready to fight, and right before walkouts they're like, he's sick, he can't do it, and you're like, what the hell, man? And then for them to be like, okay, but how about next weekend? Like, we promise next weekend. And I'd be annoyed at that. And what I'd heard initially was that they were going to do kind of a catch weight because, you know, we already did like the weigh-in sort of stuff. But don't you think you would also, if you're Ricky Tercios, kind of maybe have your antenna up for that the UFC wants this dude to do well? The UFC seems to like Raul Rosas Jr. and see him as sort of a blue chip prospect that maybe they didn't super want to get in the Ricky Tercios business here. And so if they're willing to turn right around and book him, give him catch weight, all that kind of stuff, that, you know, fighters are already ready to think that everybody from the promoter to the fans to the media are against them. I could see getting in your head about it here and being like, okay, they're going to let this guy put on a whole bunch of weight or whatever, get in there in a catch weight, give him an advantage next week.
Yeah, I mean, it's still just, it seems like a tough situation for both guys. Yeah. I assume you don't go home, right? You got to go from Mexico City to Las Vegas, most likely, I would think, and just be there for fight week. So who knows how much that disrupts your routine, or you got to do back-to-back fight week schedules and all the other stuff. I don't know. Not a great situation, especially, as you said, for a fight that I don't know we're necessarily beating down the door to see. It's not like we couldn't wait for it a little while. Next question this week comes to us from our guy Darkwing Duck, who writes, all you scumbags in the media must be crying on your keyboards as you write your apology emails to Dana White now that he's announced UFC 306 at the Sphere. So we're not just doing a show at the Sphere, Ben Folks. We're doing it pretty soon, September, UFC 306. And Dana White's going to come out here and tell us, you know, for all the naysayers that said the professional fight promoter running the professional fight organization that puts on professional fights all over the world every year, for everybody who said you're not going to be able to do it at the new multi-billion dollar event space in Las Vegas, wow, those people were wrong. They did, in fact, find a place to put the octagon in the middle of the Sphere, and we're going to do it, brother, in September.
See, this is why I'm glad that we went on record, Chad. We have it on tape.
Yeah, we do.
Check the record, bud. We went out there and we specifically said, let us be very clear, we believe you can put on an event at the Sphere. Absolutely, yeah. Believe. Yeah. No doubt in our minds that the UFC is capable of putting on a live event at a different venue in the city in which it puts on most of its live events. Had no doubt about that. So we're safe. All the other media people out there, they got to watch their asses, because do they have it?
Yeah.
Like when he comes to make the video about how Dana White was right and the media was wrong all over again, will they be able to queue up their video where they say the UFC can specifically do this? Because we got it. Our asses are covered on this one, Chad.
Yeah, that's right. We got it on tape. You know, that was what we said at the time. My first reaction was, who cares? Like, the UFC kind of does the same show everywhere they go. If they just go down the street to the Ape or to the Sphere, I don't know how much of a difference it's going to make. Since then, you know, I've had some time to think about it, and the Sphere does have all of these kind of brand new technological features that maybe we can use for this UFC event. And if they do even one different thing, I'm all for it, just to make this event look a little bit different than all the other UFC events. I do question what exactly we're going to do with all of these Sphere technology opportunities, if we're just going to have huge Black Rifle coffee company ads flying around all over the roof and the ceiling and the walls and everything else, then maybe that won't be that cool. But I don't know. We'll just have to see. Like, if they go to the Sphere and it's just like, you know, they put the tail of the tape graphic up on the fucking LED screens or whatever, is that going to be that cool? I don't know. We'll just have to wait and see.
You know what, though? If this is what it takes to get the UFC to try some different stuff and to see about getting creative and doing some cool stuff rather than just doing the same thing all over the time, then, hey, by all means, let's go ahead and say we don't think Dana White can do it. If that's what it takes, if Dana White is basically like a 10-year-old boy where you have to dare him to take out the trash, you know, like, fine. Like, I'm all for it. Whatever gets the UFC to try some new stuff, do some fun, creative stuff. When they actually try it, as we saw with that UFC Noche event, when they actually try it, they usually can do it. They usually can do something fun. And, like, I'm all for just trying some different stuff. Let's just see how it goes. So maybe if the Sphere thing is a huge success and they're really pleased with it, it'll encourage them to try to do more stuff like that, more different stuff. Fine. If the media has to be the bad guy yet again, I don't think you can do it, Dana. I don't think you can. I don't think you could pay the fighters a fair share of the revenue. No way you could do it. Go ahead, though, and prove me wrong. I'll time you, big guy. Go ahead.
Yeah, I don't think they could possibly put the Octagon in a truck and drive it down Las Vegas Boulevard down to the Sphere. It's too much to ask of those guys. Nate Diaz, he's tweeted he's coming to UFC 306. He's gonna be at that one, he said. Well, he didn't make clear in what capacity, but I assume not as a spectator.
You know, do you know that Nate Diaz will just say some stuff, though?
Silly little guy on social media.
Yeah. Yeah, 100%.
So who knows? Who knows? I can't wait for people just to be, you know, falling into seizures because they put Bruce Buffer, you know, they put Bruce Buffer's blazer, his jacket, his paisley print jacket up on the big screens at the Sphere.
Yeah, we are going to need Bruce to think about the sport coat choice on that one, because he's already, we've seen the man come out before in something that looks like a magic eye painting from like a mall in 1997. If he does that and it gets, you know, step and repeat all over the walls of the Sphere, it might cause some psychological breaks.
Next question this week comes to us from Cactus McCoy, who writes, first time writer here, so accept my humble greetings from the windy stretches of northern Germany. Thanks, Cactus. Glad you're jumping on. He writes, back to topic. After the announcement of the main event of UFC 300, I wondered why I did not feel surprised to be underwhelmed. This fight is a fine main event for any card, yet for 300 it lacks a feeling of epicness for me. So I started thinking who I'd like to see in that spot, and I felt like there is no fighter with the aura for this. No monster like Brock Lesnar, no pop icon like Conor McGregor, no supreme individual like Anderson Silva, no Amazon like Ronda Rousey. Of all active fighters, nobody feels like a brightly shining star with the power of the machine behind him or her. Is the UFC feeling the effects of prioritizing the brand itself over building fighters? And then he says, feel free to prove me wrong. This actually was related to a topic that we talked about last week on the Patreon about the perhaps unprecedented amount of turnover that we've had in the UFC at the championship level over the last year or two, when Alexander Volkanovski was defeated by Ilya Topuria a couple weeks ago. It left Leon Edwards as the longest reigning UFC champion. I believe he won in August of 2022, which kind of wipes out many of the dominant champions that we have had in the past. If you know, with the exception of John Jones, I suppose, who, you know, vacated the light heavyweight title to move up to heavyweight and is now the champion there. Although you could argue John Jones has been perhaps most notable by his inactivity over recent years. And, you know, frankly, a lot of the bigger named, well-known UFC people were booked already by the time we got into figuring out who was going to main event UFC 300. Now, whether or not you lack a person with that kind of star power, I don't necessarily know if that's a bad point. I think maybe that's true. Maybe the UFC doesn't have a Lesnar or an active McGregor or a Ronda Rousey or a George St. Pierre or an Anderson Silva right now. But one of the points I made last week is that they actually have a pretty good crop of champions for their own devices, for their own uses, you know? It seems like Ilya Topuria might end up being a pretty big star for them. We're going to talk about that, I think, in a minute. You know, they've got Zhang Weili, who is in a market that they have wanted to move into for a long time. They've got several people that I think represent those kind of emerging markets that the UFC wants to get into. And so, like, I don't think they're hurting for star power at the championship level. You know, it's just that we haven't seen people like Alexa Grasso or Zhang Weili or Sean O'Malley, or I guess is, you know, Ilya Topuria really hit their stride yet, perhaps, as champion. And maybe that was the problem. And maybe it was just that Dana White talked a big game before the event about how it was going to be so mind-blowing. And then by the time they came around to actually make the fight, even by his own admission, they were kind of down to plan C or D.
Yeah. I mean, I think that is a big part of people's disappointment in UFC 300 is because you way overpromised and overpromised not having any idea what the main event would be. And I agree, though, when you look at the full card of UFC 300, it's a good card. People fixate so much on the main event. As we've said, sometimes there's a main event where that is the whole reason you're showing up and the other stuff is just extra. And sometimes the main event is just the fight that is last. And I think that's the way to think of the UFC 300 one, because you got a bunch of good fights. One of them got to be last. It's that one. Fine. Not such a big deal if you hadn't built up expectations. One thing, though, that I think is worth noting here is that when you talk about some of these big stars of the UFC past, especially when you start with examples like Brock Lesnar, Conor McGregor, Ronda Rousey, all three of those were people who came into the UFC with a whole lot of momentum. You know, Conor McGregor, you could argue, was a really big regional star, but the way he got on the UFC map, as has become part of lore, is that Dana White went to do some speaking engagement over there in Ireland, and everybody was asking him, when is the UFC going to sign Conor McGregor? Because he had already become a big deal there. And then the UFC saw him and went, okay, you can make this guy into a thing. And so they gave him a kind of a friendly build-up in the UFC, but that it totally worked. The guy really did catch on. It turned out that what was popular with the crowd in Ireland ended up being super popular with the UFC crowd just more generally. Ronda Rousey was a big deal in Strikeforce back when the UFC was saying women will never fight in the UFC. She was on the cover of Sports Illustrated when the UFC was saying women will never fight in the UFC. So you kind of got her as a package deal when you purchased Strikeforce, she came over. Brock Lesnar obviously was a big deal in the WWE before he ever came to the UFC. So it's not like these were people that the UFC found as diamonds in the rough, polished them up, built them up from scratch. Like, no, you got these people already with something going for them. You know, George St. Pierre is much closer to an example of one where, like, he became a star in the UFC. I mean, Anderson Silva had some stuff going on when he was fighting in Japan, but he also is a little bit closer to somebody that you actually made. I think what the UFC's approach is now, in like Ilya Topuria, who, yeah, we have a question coming up on, is they're just sort of holding the fights and waiting to see who catches on. I don't think that the UFC is going to great lengths to try to build stars. I think that they're very happy having a roster of mostly interchangeable fighters, none of whom are in a position to make huge demands, all of whom need to say yes to what the UFC offers them. But then when they see somebody who has sort of organically on their own connected with the audience, like Sean O'Malley is an example, Ilya Topuria is an example, then they can see that information coming in and go, okay, time to focus a little more effort on this person because they kind of made themselves a star, not because the UFC did. I mean, UFC, well, Dana White will eagerly take all the credit for it, but I don't think that they are picking and choosing people and being like, we can make this guy a star. I think that they are seeing who already has those tendencies, who already is connecting with the audience, and then just kind of leaning into it.
Sean O'Malley rose to stardom due to the incredible backing of the fan base in the country of Montana, as far as I know.
That's right. The 406 propelled Sean O'Malley to unseen heights.
Good for him. The next question comes to us from the King of Spain, who writes, Ilia Topuria made an honorary kickoff at the Real Madrid home match, and somehow I keep seeing American fools who don't understand how big this is. Can you please talk some sense into them, or why do you guys always pretend why you were the only country in the world? this is a big deal, I think. And it does frankly seem like Ilia Topuria is going to be a big star for the UFC, at least a star, you know, in Spain, in his home country. I'm sure that that will carry over to, you know, other markets and the United States and everywhere else, which is kind of exciting, I think, as an MMA fan to think that we could potentially have another one of these sort of watershed individuals or breakout stars on our hands that could make things a little bit more interesting moving forward for a while. But of course, you got to win the fights in order to continue to be that person. But I do think, yeah, at least since he beat Volkanovski a few weeks ago, Topuria seems like he's on a rocket to the stars. And this Real Madrid thing, which I have to understand, is like a huge honor in Spain to bring you out there and have you do this ceremonial honorary kickoff thing, just is another example of that. And so hopefully the UFC will be able to capitalize on that. And hopefully we as fans will be able to kind of enjoy the ride and fuck the haters who would tell you that if it didn't happen on this side of the pond, it doesn't matter.
Yeah. I mean, I think that a lot of American fans, just because they don't follow European soccer leagues, they don't understand what a huge deal it is. But like that Real Madrid is one of the most well-known professional sports brands in the world. And a ton of eyes are on that. And it's also, it's not like throwing out the first pitch at a Cubs game in May, where whatever, it was going to be you or it was going to be Charo, and nobody much cares which one it was. Like, that's a much bigger deal. He got a huge reception, and he does seem to have all the pieces in play there. Like, I mean, he's a charismatic guy. He's got an exciting fighting style, good-looking guy. Walks out there in a suit, in a finely cut suit. He's not even doing the Conor McGregor thing where it looks like he went to the tailor and was like, make me a suit for a man two sizes smaller than me so that my muscles seem like they're about to tear the seams. Like, hey, the guy walks out there looking great, looking like a big-time sports star with the UFC belt over him. Like, that is a big deal, and he's getting a huge reception over there. And what we've seen before, like with the Conor McGregor thing, is that if you have a country behind you, and especially a country that doesn't have a whole lot of other athletes in this space to cheer for, and they hear about it, the UFC loves that because it's like, okay, now you might get a whole bunch of eyeballs that are not in the MMA bubble. Now you have a chance to capture a whole new audience. Some of them might become MMA fans. Most of them maybe will drift away if Ilia Topuria drifts away. But it's a huge opportunity, and you didn't really have to do that much for it. The guy just sort of showed up and was super, super good and does a good job of kind of selling and marketing the fights himself. So, it is a huge deal. And as Americans, we are not about to stop pretending that we are the only country in the world. Listen, we don't even bother to learn that much about our own history and culture. Americans are not about to learn why Real Madrid is a big deal if they don't already know. Like, give up on those people, King of Spain. You are not going to reach them.
All right, that's going to do it for listener mail this week. If you have a question, comment, or concern that you would like to air to the podcast in future weeks, you know how to do it. Go to the website, comainevent.com, and click the link in the top corner of the screen that says email the podcast. That'll get you in touch with us. Right now, we're going to go ahead and get started with round number one.
Mom.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Well, Ben, Brian Ortega came to some of the pre-fight media events the week leading up to this fight night down there in Mexico City, prepared to tell an obviously bullshit story about Eagles. Talking about how Eagles, when they turn 35 or so, they fly up to this secluded mountain area and they crunch off their beaks against the rocks and they pull their own talons out and they stay there until their beaks and their talons grow back in, and then they fly back down and they live for another 35 years. They live to be like 70 years old. None of that is true. It takes 2 seconds to Google that story to find out that it's like one of these internet kind of chain mail style hoaxes, you know, just an untrue myth, basically, is what
some
it is.
Snopes but, ass shit is what we refer to it as on the Power Hour.
That's right. But, you know, I love it for Brian Ortega. If that's what it takes for him to tell himself this story of his own kind of rebirth and reemergence into the UFC after not competing there due to what, you know, I think it was the shoulder injury since 2022. He comes back in this fight early on. Looks like he is going to get absolutely run over by Yair Rodriguez. He got battered. He got dropped. His nose got smashed. He got his whole shit broke. Just about somehow winds up in mount by the end of the first round. And after that point, kind of collected himself and took over, ends up winning in the third round with an amazing trip takedown and then a gnarly ass, you know, arm triangle choke to get the victory here. And I don't know. I thought it was a feel good moment to see Brian Ortega come out and get this win after, you know, being away for so long and getting a win that it felt like he really, really needed to get in his career.
Yeah, I mean, that's what we were saying before this one, right? Was that it seemed like this was a potential career crossroads for Brian Ortega. And he seemed to be feeling that too. Otherwise, this rebirth of the Eagle thing does not become so important to you if you don't feel like you are on the verge of dying and need to crunch up your own beak. You know, the other thing we said about that after, although even though it's obviously bullshit, the whole Eagle thing, the thing Greg Jackson used to say about how most of the stories we tell ourselves are bullshit, so you might as well pick the one that's going to help you. If that helped Brian Ortega, then so be it. Honestly, there were a lot of ways for this to be a bad night for Brian Ortega. You know, you go in there, you hurt your ankle during the introductions, you get dropped right away by a dangerous striker, Yair Rodriguez. A lot of that, like, we have seen a lot of people who, if they had had that number of things go wrong for them that quickly, it would have been really easy for them to go, well, shit, to panic, to sort of give up mentally and get beat real quickly. And Brian Ortega being able to collect himself as quickly as he did, come back and sort of take over that fight just on grappling alone, like, that's super impressive. And he really, really did need that. I think it's an open question as far as where it puts him right now. Because I saw people reacting to it to just be like, okay, hey, don't talk to me about a title shot after that. Just because, you know, hey, good win at featherweight for Brian Ortega, but it is also his first win since, you know, October of 2020. I don't know if you can lose two straight, roll in, win one fight against a fellow contender and get right in there for the title fight sweepstakes. I mean, I would say if we were running that kind of sport, sure. it wouldn't work that way. But we all know that we're not exactly running that kind of sport.
I mean, we've seen crazier things happen.
Absolutely. And I think, like, if you're trying to make a fight for Ilya Topuria and you are maybe against Ilya Topuria's wishes, choosing from the existing featherweight contenders, and you look at, like, who would be an interesting stylistic challenge, but who would also be a personality that can help you sell the fight, Brian Ortega is going to be on that short list, you know?
Yeah.
I think that makes good sense. So I wouldn't hate it if that's how it ended up going. I also think that this could be one of those situations where the UFC has a list of three guys that could potentially be next title fight contenders, and you start calling around and see who says yes to the date you already have circled on the calendar. That could easily be how it gets decided. But this is a big, big win for Brian Ortega to be able to go out there and do that, and especially when it seemed like things were not going so great for your boy very early on.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, I feel like he showed some of the different things he can do in this fight. I don't know if it was a y'all must have forgot kind of moment, but you know, he definitely showed his heart and his chin and his ability to come back from this adversity. But I thought he also showed, you know, a willingness and a capability for doing what he needed to do against Yair Rodriguez, both on the feet and on the mat. Like, he made no bones about the fact that he knew that what he needed to do was get in Rodriguez's face in the striking game and pressure him, and was able to do that. Kind of got punched in his face several times, especially in the first round. But, you know, after that first round, I thought he had some success in doing that. And then, you know, one of the things we have historically talked about with really good jiu-jitsu people is that they don't always have the takedowns, you know, that could really benefit them to try to control where the fight is contested, to put the fight into the place where they are the strongest. I thought Brian Ortega had a couple of really nice takedowns in this thing. And of course, once you get him on the ground, that's where he lives. Yeah. That's his kitchen. And you're going to, you know, have to deal with him down there. And obviously Yair Rodriguez wasn't really up to the challenge getting in that position a couple of times. A wise man said last week, always take Brian Ortega by submission. Always throw a little bet down on Brian Ortega by submission, because you never know. You never know what'll happen.
Here we go. I knew it. I was just waiting for you to mention that one. I mean, I will say, you made the exact same argument about taking Mackenzie Dern via submission.
You always do it, just because you never know what's going to happen. Like, if it goes down there, either one of those kids could win a fight at the drop of a hat, because they have those kind of skills. So I'll take it. I'll take it when it hits. As for whether or not it qualifies him for a title shot, I think you're probably still waiting around to see what happens when Max Holloway fights Justin Gaethje. If Max Holloway wins that, then I think he's the odds on favorite to be the number one contender, especially if it works out schedule wise, as you mentioned. But I mean, you got to consider Yair Rodriguez and Brian Ortega came into this fight ranked 3 and 4. Respectively, on those featherweight rankings. Alexander Volkanovski is still up at number one, so I guess worst comes to worst, you could do an immediate rematch between Topuria and Volkanovski. But the only guy ahead of him at this point is Max Holloway, and you got to think Ortega will jump up to at least number three in those rankings. Aside from that, I don't necessarily know if you have a real great option as a contender, so there might be two or three guys on that list, and one of them is Brian Ortega. I think that in all likelihood, he probably gets absolutely murked by Ilya Topuria. But like I said, can't count that dude out, especially after what we saw on Saturday. Just, you know, he's going to be there. If he gets you in a position that he likes, it's good for him. He could beat you.
Yeah.
He could beat just about anybody from those positions. What now for Yair Rodriguez, I guess, is my question. We answered a couple questions last week about how Rodriguez has had a very weird UFC career up to this point, and he's only 31 years old, so he's clearly not done. But he is now 2-3 in his last five. And those losses are Max Holloway, Volkanovski, and Ortega, so a bunch of good fighters mixed in there. But there was a time, you know, late 2010s, 2017, 2016, where we really thought Yair Rodriguez was a budding star, that he was on this trajectory straight up to the top, and things just haven't worked out for him owing to a bunch of different reasons inside and outside of the cage. But I feel like, you know, once again, he's put himself in kind of a weird position here where I'm not totally sure what the way forward is for him.
Yeah, I think that this fight, and also the Alexander Volkanovski fight to some extent, showed that there are still some holes in Yair Rodriguez's game that against the cream of the crop at featherweight, you have a whole bunch of guys who can exploit those. You know, obviously he's a great fighter, an exciting fighter, and when he gets to do his stuff. And then when other people get to counter it with their stuff, especially wrestling, grappling related stuff, he sometimes finds himself in some trouble. And I think that it's not like I would look at losses to Alexander Volkanovski and Brian Ortega and be like, that means you suck. Because those are two good fighters. You know, one of them
right.
Among, if not the featherweight GOAT at this point. And so, I don't know. He does seem like at 31, you're going to look around pretty quickly and be like, okay, you need to go out there and prove to some of these people that they can't just keep taking you down and beating you up on the mat. You know, and the good news is that there are a whole lot of interesting matchups for him still at featherweight. The bad news is that featherweight has so many good guys and so many well-rounded guys that anybody who fights Yair Rodriguez next is going to be looking at what Brian Ortega did and go, okay, I'm going to make him prove he can stop that before I stand there and get into a face-kicking match with Yair Rodriguez.
All right, let's go ahead. We'll do Are You Fucking Kidding Me? And then we'll move on to round number two. Ben, you mentioned this earlier, but the wild multi-person brawl in the stands at this UFC Mexico City event. Just a wild melee involving multiple people. One that you know, seemed to go on for a while as compared to how many of these things go. Dana White was asked about it at the post-fight press conference. He was asked basically if he thought it was a bad look for the UFC, to which, you know, he all but snorted and gave the reporter who asked that question sort of a dirty look. He said, I mean, that never happens. Literally never happens. It happened here in Mexico City. The crazy thing about that fight, when that fight broke out, it felt like it kept going forever. So I ran over there and I was watching it and nobody stopped it. I was waiting for security to come in and they just let them go until it was over. That was one of the craziest things I've ever seen. I don't think it's a bad look for the UFC. It happened and that was the end of that. Now, it's hard to know what he means by that never happens.
Yeah.
Because I would agree with the point that maybe we never see a fight, or don't see many fights that go on quite to that extent. But we almost had a big brawl in the stands at UFC 294 in October between multiple dudes and Paulo Costa. Does anyone remember that? Where there was guys trying to jump over the security railing to get at Paulo Costa. We had Sean Strickland going after DDP in the crowd at UFC 296. I've seen multiple fights at the UFC when I have gone, both as media and as fans. Sometimes we used to joke about how there was a fight at every UFC that you went to. It's almost the anomaly when you don't see a fight in the stands. So, you know, depending on what he means, are you fucking kidding me? Let's not pretend like this is a one-off. Maybe this is the craziest fight we've seen, but honestly, I don't think it's that out of the ordinary to see this kind of stuff happened at the UFC.
Yeah, maybe the longest or the biggest or the wildest fight, but yeah, just from my time covering UFC events as a media member, I feel like I have and just carry around in my head a top five UFC crowd fights I've ever seen list. Way up there on the list, by the way, is the dude in Winnipeg who got into a huge brawl right by the beer concession stand, got his shirt all ripped off and face all bloodied. And then as he was being led away in handcuffs, tried to do the fake lunge at somebody who was laughing at him. It's like, bro, the fake lunge doesn't work when we can see you in handcuffs. Nobody's going to flinch at that one. So yeah, the stuff has been known to happen. I also, though, the argument that it's a bad look for the UFC, it's a bad look for arena staff, for arena security, because they are the ones supposed to be on top of that one. So, are you fucking kidding me? Jed, my are you fucking kidding me this week? You know, we thought it a little curious when Henry Cejudo went out there, lost to Merab Dvalishvili, standing there with his gloves off in the cage, and we thought, okay, Henry Cejudo looks like he's ready to tell us again that he's retired, which he said he would do if he lost. And the UFC refused to give him even a shred of a moment there. Dana White said afterwards, you don't give Henry Cejudo the mic there. That's Merab's moment. Henry Cejudo already retired in the cage once. He got to do his thing. We're not giving him the chance again. And then lo and behold, Henry Cejudo goes and proves him right.
Yeah.
goes out with just wastes almost no time for coming out with a video being like, I'm not retired, I'm coming back. Then takes aim here at Brandon Moreno. Here's his quote. What fight would be better than Triple C, the Mexican-American versus the true Mexican? And they come together and they do a 5-round showdown at the Sphere in Las Vegas for Mexican Independence Day. I like it. If there's any way that we should settle it, enough talking, enough cringe, and enough antics, and enough all of that, the only way to get it on Brandon Moreno is I accept your challenge. Let's do it. Mexican Independence Day, what you got? You sign that contract. Are you a Mexican or a Mexicant?
Ooh, wow.
Are you fucking kidding me? You were just standing there with your gloves off. Just the other weekend, man. The worst thing is that you make Dana White look like a wise sage of the fight game here by not giving you the microphone, not giving you a chance to do. What were you going to do? You're going to stand there and retire on a UFC pay-per-view and then turn right around and be like, nah, just joking, you guys. Are you fucking kidding me, Cejudo?
I don't think we should let MMA fighters use the word retire anymore. We got to come up with a different word. It's got to be like, I'm taking a respite. I'd like to announce my respite from the sport, or like I'm suspending my campaign maybe as a UFC fighter. Just, I mean, I guess in Henry Cejudo's case, you hang a back in 5 minutes sign in the window, because I don't know, man. But that was an Are You Fucking Kidding Me moment for me as well. Alright, you fucking kidding me? Let's go ahead and get started with round number two.
Well, Chad, the main event over there in Mexico City, we had ourselves the Battle of the Brandons. And you know what? I could kind of forgive MMA judges on this one if they just sort of closed their eyes at the end of five rounds and went, I don't know, Brandon won. Because Brandon Royval comes out here, gets a split decision over Brandon Moreno, close fight, back and forth. You know, I did see Brandon Royval, I believe on his Facebook page, Chad, came out here and says that he believes he tore his MCL in the first round of this fight, which, if true, that's pretty impressive to do 4 more rounds and come away with the victory there. What'd you make of this one as far as, you know, the actual fight itself and then what it means for the flyweight division, where, as we've seen lately, it's been the same 3 guys fighting each other a whole bunch?
Yeah, I mean, it's flyweights are so fun to watch. You know, like, they're so fast, they're so active, there's so much back and forth action between them in a lot of these fights. And I also feel like that is one of the things that makes these fights hard to judge, because a lot of times you have a hard time kind of coming up with an answer to who came out on top in which round. And so, you know, we always get in these situations where you go out there for round 5 and everybody is basically throwing up their hands and saying, this is for the fight. You know, as whoever wins this round, this is for all the marbles. And, you know, I did look, it seemed like Brandon Royval won most of the decisions, or most of the verdicts on MMADecisions.com. So maybe he was the rightful victor here. But like I said at the top of the show, it seemed like either Brandon could have won this thing. Thought Brandon Moreno clearly won the first couple of rounds. And then maybe he faded a little bit toward the end, and Royval was able to come on. And I don't know if that was a sort of Mexico City effect or whatever, but I saw someone tweet, I can't remember who it was, but they were basically saying that it's possible that Brandon Royval might have set a UFC record for missed strikes in this fight, because he was definitely the fresher fighter at the end, but Brandon Moreno was landing approximately like 40% of the strikes that he threw. And I thought personally that he mostly landed the heavier strikes in this fight as well. And, you know, Royval definitely matched him and exceeded him on output, but he threw so many of his punches. And when I checked, it looked like he landed less than 30% of them. So I was wondering, are we basically scoring these fights, especially when they're flyweights and they're so fast that sometimes it can be hard to tell exactly what happened in there? Are we basically scoring these fights based on who looks the most active and aggressive?
I mean, I don't think that that's true just at flyweight. I think that if there's a way to kind of game the system with MMA judging, it's to be looking like you are doing more or doing more to more effect, whether you are or are not. And I think we've seen that before. I remember, you know, Diego Sanchez definitely got a decision or two that maybe he didn't deserve, just because even if he's bloodied up, he's still just looking like he's doing a whole lot. And if you're throwing a whole bunch of punch flurry stuff late in the round, even if they're not really landing clean, you can sometimes convince the judges in a close fight that that's the thing that makes a difference. I think we honestly saw some of that with the Sean Strickland DDP fight recently, where Sean Strickland is, you know, doing his Sean Strickland thing, but DDP is throwing everything that looks like a big strike. Every single thing looks like he's loading up on it. And whether it lands or not, whether it outweighs the volume of Sean Strickland or not, judges can be affected by that. So, like, I would not be surprised if you tell me that somebody doing more, even if it doesn't have as great an effect, can sort of trick the judges, especially if it's close, man. You know, like, as you said, like, especially the flyweights just do so much in any given round over the course of 5 minutes. Which portion of the fight do you choose and be like that, or which portion of the round do you choose and say that was the most significant?
Yeah, I was honestly kind of wondering if the opposite thing of DDP was true for Brandon Moreno, because he was throwing those kind of like ponderous overhand rights. And during the last few rounds, he missed them. And I was like, is it just more clear to the judges that this guy's whiffing on his giant punches? And, you know, Royval is throwing this huge volume of strikes, but most of them just appear to be either missing or going off the guard of Moreno. So I don't know. I'm not going to argue with the decision. I thought either guy could have won. Most people thought they had Royval winning it. And so that, I guess, is fine. I think one of the awkward things about this fight, because it was, you had two guys main event fighting in a potential number one contender spot who have both lost to the champion twice already, and you had Pantoja out there sitting cage side being a silly little guy putting up the 5-0, going 5-0 with his hands to tell you that neither of these guys was going to end up beating him. So you had that. But I mean, again, I don't know that there's a real clear-cut number one contender. And if you told me it was going to be Brandon Royval again, I guess, taking another swing for the flyweight title, I would accept it, because obviously they're going to be good fights. So whatever.
This is your official stance on the flyweight division in the UFC. They're all going to be good fights. So whatever.
Yeah, it's fine. Tell me two guys are fighting and I'll just be like, all right, I will probably tune in for that and be mystified by the decision.
Yeah.
How about Royval kind of coming out of his shell a little bit here at the end of the fight in the post-fight interview, maybe following a little bit of Renato Moicano vibes here, where you put a mic in his face, he just kind of, he goes off. And I believe one of the things he said was, I'm going to people's houses and I'm taking their shit all day. So planning a burglary
figuratively
is
doing that.
He's snatching their chain, I think is what he meant, that he's going to go into hostile territory against whoever and get the win in the fight. I think he's speaking figuratively there, but still, if you're going to give me a post fight speech that sounds like you're planning a burglary, planning a heist, I guess I'm into it.
Yeah. All day too. Just like he's going house to house, just while everybody's at work, you come home. There's that like cartoonish little spot on the wall where the TV used to be, just the outline of the TV. And you're like, Brandon Royval has been here. He took my shit again all day.
Yeah. It's a thing that happens. Saif Saeed is a very intense corner.
Yeah, he is.
He's like a couple of fights that I watched him corner, I was like, he must be tailoring his approach to these individual fighters, and he must know that the thing that motivates them the most is if you yell swear words at them. But now I just watch all these fights, like he's basically getting in everybody's face, calling him a motherfucker. And like, if that works, man, I'm into it. But it's just, he's got an intense style over there.
Wasn't he also the one in this Ian Machado, Gary and Jeff Neal fight who, when Ian Gary kept wanting to, you know, fist bump and everything like during the fight, and Jeff Neal went for it the first time, and then I think it was him that you could hear him yelling, "Stop fucking dapping him up," and just like, yeah, you know what, I'm a side with Saif on this one.
All right, I guess that's going to do it for round number two. We will be right back with round number three. Well, Ben, it was the first pay-per-view of the Bellator-PFL merger era. It went down over there in Saudi Arabia and therefore aired relatively early in the day here in the United States. You had a smattering of championships here fighting for the Super Belt, as they are referred to here on the Wikipedia page of this event. The Bellator fighters in these PFL versus Bellator matchups kind of rolled. You had Aaron Pico, AJ McKee, Yoel Romero, Vadim Nemkov, Johnny Eblen all ended up getting wins. The one real standout loss for the Bellator guys, of course, was at the heavyweight division where Hernan Ferreira knocked out Ryan Bader in just 21 seconds. That fight is perhaps most notable because the PFL announced last week that the winner of that fight would be the one to fight Francis Ngannou in his MMA return. And now we'll just have to wait and see if that's actually the case for Hernan Ferreira and whether or not he will be the one who gets to go out there and get that $2 million. But we talked about Ferreira a little bit last week on the Patreon. Big guy, heavy hands, long reach. Pretty much used those qualities and put the stamp on Ryan Bader real fast.
Yeah. I mean, in retrospect, seeing, 42-year-old Ryan Bader go out there and then try to punch his way in to close the distance, but then end up still inside the distance right after he throws and get clipped, I guess maybe should not have been such a huge surprise to us. Here's what I'll say. I don't understand. In the aftermath of this, I saw a bunch of people attempting to get their meme game on social media, talking about how the winner here is really going to be the loser because he's got to turn around and fight Franny and Guns afterwards. Chad, have they forgotten that's how you get the $2 million? You get the guaranteed $2 million.
That $2 million
doesn't matter if you go out there and you get wrecked by Francis Ngannou, and in a move that we have never really seen before in fight sports. Francis Ngannou made sure to negotiate a minimum purse for his opponent, which nobody else really ever seems to care about, as long as they make more than the opponent. So, I would think, you know, people maybe they don't understand the mind of the typical pro fighter because they think I would be terrified to fight Francis Ngannou. Hell yeah, you would be. We all would be. Except for some dude who fights in a cage for a living, and he's going to think not only is he going to go out there and shock the world against Francis Ngannou, but he's going to get that $2 million, Chad.
Yeah. Obviously, we don't know when or if that will happen. Francis Ngannou still has to fight Anthony Joshua here in a couple of weeks. And he has been upfront about the fact that his future will depend largely on what happens on that night. And, you know, I've already said win, lose, or draw. I'm not so sure Tyson Fury doesn't just roll back up in there and be like, hey, let's do it again, brother. Even if Ngannou loses, I think that could be a fight that makes sense for Tyson Fury. Just to kind of get his shine back, get his aura back, so to speak. But you know, everybody involved in the situation seems to indicate that it's going to happen, that Francis Ngannou will come back and fight for the PFL at some point. And look, man, there's nobody who is a bigger Francis Ngannou fan than me. And I don't think it's out of the question that Hernan Ferreira would win that fight either. If you got two guys that are going to go out there and swang them thangs, you know, if Ferreira hits you, you could get knocked out. And we have seen in the past that sometimes Francis Ngannou's strategy has been, I'm just going to wade in there and throw hammers, and I'm going to bet that if I hit you, you will get knocked out, and that if you hit me, I won't. And so, you know, you do that against this guy who's like 6'8" knockout power, and you might get yourself in trouble.
Yeah, honestly, I think that this is the better case scenario for PFL, because if you roll in there with Ryan Bader, guy in his 40s who at this point feels like a pretty known commodity to MMA fans, I'll give Ryan Bader credit. Like, he made the most of his post-UFC career and really did a lot with it, and showed that life does not end for an MMA fighter after exiting the UFC. But if you're looking for the guy that you could conceivably promote with, a guy you could put on the poster with Francis Ngannou do one of those things where the way you sell this fight is just by listing the heights and the weights of the two dudes involved and just being like, don't you want to see that? Like,
yeah.
And a guy who feels like less of a dude we have the entire book on. And so I think you can really work with that. The question is, as we've talked about, do you get the chance anytime soon? Because to say like, hey, Francis Ngannou going to fight the winner of this fight, fine. Say that all you want. But we all know that depending on what happens with Francis's potentially incredibly lucrative boxing career from here on out, that could really change the calculus about when he comes back to MMA.
Yeah, and he's 36 right now, I think. He might not even come back till he's 37, at which point, he'll be pretty long in the tooth for an MMA fighter, and I think anything could happen when he does that. I want to talk a little bit generally about this pay-per-view and then about the future of what could happen here for this new PFL Bellator monster and what it could be. I can't imagine they pulled a great number on pay-per-view for this thing, especially since it was kind of on in the middle of the day, both because they were in Saudi Arabia and maybe they figured it wasn't such a bad idea to not just go head to head with what the UFC was going to do. I don't know that they planned on getting a good number. I don't know that it matters to them whether or not they got a good or a bad number. It seemed like we were not even close to being at full capacity in the arena. And so I wonder if one of the problems here, which has been the problem for a long time in any kind of UFC competitor world, is that they're going to have a bunch of really good fighters in this thing, in the PFL Bellator merger, because they got everybody's fighters. And I think you saw that on Saturday, that they have dudes like Johnny Eblen. They have dudes like Nemkov, AJ McKee, Aaron Pico, Clarissa Shields. And are they going to be able to get even a little bit of attention?
Yeah.
For the stuff that they're going to do.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, the issue is not that there's no talent on the roster, especially at this point.
This was the better card, right? If you just looked at the UFC and the PFL Bellator thing, this was the better fight card of the weekend.
Well, and it ought to be because you're charging pay-per-view prices for it, where the UFC is out there on a fight night available for just the subscription price on ESPN+. But yeah, you are at this point still kind of chopping trees down in the forest with nobody around to hear. And trying to bridge that gap, the sort of awareness and interest gap, it's tough, especially because, sadly, it is not enough to just be like, look how many good fighters we have. If that were enough, we'd have seen people be able to make more headway. Because, like, as we saw with how well a lot of those Strikeforce fighters did after the UFC bought Strikeforce and brought them over, the issue was not that they're just a lower tier. You know, the UFC still wants to act like that. Like when they bring in Kayla Harrison, and Dana White is already talking about like, hey, it's a whole different level over here. And it's like, yeah, is it though? You know, we've seen that there are a lot of good fighters outside the UFC who can come right in and do really, really well. The issue is for so many fans still, the UFC brand is the sport. Now, PFL has the advantage of like having an in with ESPN, and who knows how the next UFC rights negotiation goes, you know, maybe you could get a little more of a foothold there. I don't know. But like right now, it is still the battle, because you put on a card like this, you want to be able to say, this is a pay-per-view card. You should be willing to pay pay-per-view prices to see this kind of thing. And intellectually, I don't disagree with you. And yet that does not necessarily seem to be the way it works in real life.
Yeah. How do you think Scott Coker is feeling? It seems like this has happened to him now more than once, right? Happened with Strikeforce, happened with Bellator, where he's out there, you got to think, doing his best with the cards that he's dealt. And both times, at least in the short term here with the Bellator PFL pay-per-view, both times the company that ends up buying his company gets a bunch of gems, right? Daniel Cormier, Ronda Rousey, Nick Diaz, Robbie Lawler, all these guys make it into the UFC from Strikeforce. Obviously, some of them had been in the UFC prior to that, but like all of those people became huge deals in the UFC, and many of them were very, very good. Several of them became champions. And now the PFL buys Bellator, and they put on this pay-per-view, and basically all your dudes smoke their dudes. So if you're Scott Coker, are you sitting at home right now being like, see, See, we got our guys are good. We got badasses over here. Or are you sitting there being like, I had all these good fighters and I couldn't make it work?
I think at this point, Scott Coker is an old dog in this game. He knows how it goes. And I think that, I hope that he is capable of taking some pride in that, whether anybody else notices it or not. And I don't think that he's going to sit around for too long and go like, this proves that I should have been able to do more and that, you know, the talent was there. Because as we said, the talent's not the issue. PFL is going to face the same problem that you faced, even with a whole bunch of your fighters now. I think you got to be able to take some kind of pride in knowing, like, those were my guys. They were, in fact, really good. We did know how to pick them. We had built up a good roster of fighters. And the fact that it didn't matter has to do more with facts of this industry than it does a failure on your part as a promoter.
Yeah. All right, let's do Just Saying Stuff, and then we will get out of here for this week. Ben, what is your Just Saying Stuff?
Chad, this week, I'm just saying, you know how you get me to click on your story?
Have it be called Misha Tate Through the Years and just have it be a slideshow?
You have a headline, a little something like this. This one I'm finding on yardbarker.com, and it just says, Chuck Liddell falls off boat into San Diego Bay. That's it. That's, you got me. You know? That's all you needed. You don't need to justify why you're posting this image, this video. You don't need to explain anything else to me. Chuck Liddell falls off boat into San Diego Bay. Yes, I need to see what that is about. And in fact, it comes from this. It basically comes from Twitter, from Championship Rounds at Champ RDS. And it's just a video. I mean, I think it's just maybe posted on TMZ Sports initially, but like just a video. Chuck Liddell, he's standing there with two guys on a boat. One of them's holding the camera. I don't know if it's just the bobbing of the boat up and down in water, as somebody else notes in the replies, quote, bro got taken out by a gust of wind. Chuck Liddell's standing there talking, gesturing with his arms, and around the time the guy he's talking to tries to turn and seem to mug for the camera that is recording them from the shore, Chuck gestures a little too enthusiastically and then whoop, 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 just falls backwards off this boat in his t-shirt and jeans, looking very much like a gentleman of a certain age. You know?
And if you're Chuck Liddell, it's not like you can be like, I hope nobody saw that. Right? Yeah, everybody's going to see it.
Yeah. And then somebody got to jump in the water to help him get back out. Everybody's got t-shirt and jeans are all soaked by the end of it. I'm just saying, you know, you got me. Once you come up with that headline, you just flat out got me.
Well, Ben, there's drama. There's scandal. Big drama show over there in the world of sumo wrestling. You had one of your 22-year-old rising stars of the sport forced to retire after a bullying scandal inside the sumo stable that he was a part of. You had the celebrated, potentially greatest of all time, Hakuho, former Yokozuna, who was running this stable, essentially got busted down to private. He got demoted by the Japanese Sumo Association, had to take a retirement pay cut over all this. If you want to know the specifics, the details, you can go find it online. But I mean, this week, I'm just saying, couple of weeks, March 10th, March Basho, the big March tournament gets underway. Everybody who's listened to this show or listens to the Patreon stuff knows that one of our vows, our sacred vows for the year, one of our New Year's resolutions was that we're going to get super into sumo. And I'm telling you, man, if you're not following the sumo, I'm just saying, you're fucking up. You're fucking up. You got to come follow the sumo. You can watch it for free. The matches themselves take like 10 seconds. It's amazing. You got to come watch it. I'm just saying, you're fucking up if you're not watching the sumo.
Just saying. You know, we noted this when we were talking about this scandal on the Power Hour, and the fact that the Japanese Sumo Association can effectively force you into retirement will not put up with any nonsense when they hear about you messing up. Won't be like, hey, we hired a law firm to do an internal investigation, the results of which will be they tell us that everything is fine because that's what we paid them to tell us. They don't mess around with that stuff. The Japanese Sumo Association seems in many ways to be what we like to pretend state athletic commissions are. They will get your ass.
You mess up. Yes, they will. All right, that's going to do it for this week's Co-Main Event Podcast. We'll be over on the Patreon page all week. Check us out over there, patreon.com/co-main-event. As for the rest of you, we'll talk to you next week. For right now, we are done, we are through, we are out.
Can you imagine if like a Nevada State Athletic Commission came up with rules where they were like, from now on, we've seen too many problems. MMA fighters can no longer drive cars.
Hey, man, I'm on record saying I think we should give the Japanese Sumo Association a chance to run MMA. Just for like 6 months, just to see how it goes. Unfortunately, by the time we got to the end of that, we wouldn't have any fighters left. They all would have, all of their retirement letters would have been accepted. Their letters of resignation would have been accepted by the Sumo Association.
I'm just saying, if the Japanese Sumo Association had been able to bring that over to MMA, there'd be a pregnant lady in New Mexico who didn't get her arm broken. You know, there'd be somebody out there in Southern California who didn't end up with Tony Ferguson's truck upside down on top of their parked car. There's just a whole lot of stuff that could have been avoided.